What I've given you is a handout from Paramahansa Yogananda on Patanjali. It's one of his first talks on Patanjali. And just to set a little background for all of this, that Paramahansa Yogananda came to America in 1920. And he really came to bring meditation into the culture, where it hadn't been such a prominent part. Of course, in Christian mysticism, and particularly Catholic mysticism, meditation had been a big part of that, but it had not necessarily carried through into more modern-day prayer is there. But there's a quote that says something to the effect that prayer without meditation is like asking a question without bothering to wait for a response. So it's learning how to get quiet inside. And there's a lot of ways of being able to do that. There are active meditations, there's walking meditations, there are sitting meditations. People who go off into the caves and into seclusive nature in order to meditate. Other people who can sit in a crowded room with lots of noise and be able to meditate. Sit on a bus and be able to meditate. So there's a wide variety of methods and avenues to get to it. But the yogis in India have perhaps taken it to more of a science and perfection than anyone else has. They've really put a lot of time and energy into how to do this and how to get the best out of it. One of the things they discovered was the connection with breath and mind and spirit. And in fact, spiritus in its original language means to breathe. And so what they discovered was that when you change the breathing, the mind changes. Or conversely, if the breathing will reflect what the mind is going on with. So if you're really upset, you're really angry, you may be breathing really hard, like a bellows, just going for it, you know. Or you may hold your breath completely, which you can't do for very long, but you can do that. It's a reflection of the psycho-emotional state that you're in at the time. If you observe somebody who's in very concentrated state, say somebody who's a chess champion and they're looking at the chessboard and you watch their breathing, you would notice they'd hardly be breathing at all. Somebody, if you're taking a thread and trying to put it through the eye of the needle, you might even hold your breath just while you're trying to do that very, very exact thing. So breath-mind relationship is very powerful. And that if you begin to observe your breath begins to change. So this was a very fundamental kind of discovery, this kind of relationship, and it's carried through to lots of different kinds of disciplines and lots of different ways of approaching meditation. But if we just read a little bit, I'll read out loud. You can either just listen or you can follow along. Talking about Patanjali. And Patanjali, somewhere between 200 BC and 200 AD, that kind of range was there. And he really articulated kind of a very, very broad, common sense kind of approach to yoga. And yoga means union. And ultimately, it's the spiritual union. It's union with the divine, union with God, is what yoga is for. Today, we hear it a lot as hatha yoga, and hatha yoga is really seen as a means for preparing the body to meditate. It makes you healthy. It balances the energy in your body so that when you sit down to meditate, you're not fighting the body, which can be a huge distraction. So it goes that far, but oftentimes yoga classes don't go much further than that. and meditation doesn't even get much of a mention, if at all. So this is really taking it to the next step. What's it all for in the first place? So Patanjali was said to have a wonderful power. He could do almost anything, materialize his body or dematerialize his body. Patanjali is spoken of as having married, and that his marriage didn't in any way interfere with his development. Then Yogananda, who is a monk, goes on to say, but if anybody gets married as a necessity, he has to reincarnate again to come to the point where he would know no one but God. And I don't completely agree with Master on this one, that I think Lahari Mahasaya came. I think he would agree with me, by the way. But this is what he said in this one particular place, that Lahari Mahasaya came to show and demonstrate that somebody who is married can go the whole way. The reason for that is, for monks in particular, the idea of going out and meditating, and one reason they begin to remove themselves from society is because of the distractions. You sit down to meditate, if there's somebody's got the boom box going next door and you can hear the music, if people are talking, if there's noise, all of that draws the mind out. Draws it out through your hearing, through touch, through sense of smell. And so they began to gradually withdraw themselves further and further away from all those stimulations in order to get quiet. The environment then supported them in order to get quiet. Now, most of us can't afford that in one way or another, to withdraw ourselves from society. Nor would it even be preferable if the vast majority began to do that. So these techniques that we're going to be discussing around meditation don't require you to do that, although as Ramakrishna said today, it's beneficial if there are some times when you can take time away from everything and really get quiet. I spent a year some years ago in silence and in solitude. And for the first 2 weeks, I'd been traveling around quite a bit and talking to different people before I went into silence. And I knew that there would be a time of just the motor would be running at a higher RPM. It's just when we're doing and doing and doing and doing, the machinery of the body is just running at a higher RPM. And it takes a little while for that to kick down and to drop into a lower rate. It just takes time to do that. So I thought, well, probably a week or two anyway. And that's about what it was. So entering into silence, there's just a lot of energy, a lot of thought, everything that was just going and going and going. And then after about 2 weeks, it just all dropped down. And that's what vacation's really about for a lot of people, isn't it? Is to go someplace, be someplace where there's not a lot of stimulation, where there's not a lot going on, and eventually your RPMs drop down. And when you do that, you feel what? Refreshed, relaxed, going back to all the activity again. Well, for these yogis, they said, oh, we really want to explore this notion of what it is to get quiet. So we're really going to take our time. So they withdrew themselves further and further and further. And any kind of stimulation just seemed invasive. So eventually they would go into a cave with these granite rocks all around them, huge insulation against the worldly vibrations and the stuff that's going on about the world. And they could really drop into this deep, 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 deep place. And they found that was just required in order to get to that kind of depth. However, Lahari Mahasaya, who is one of our teachers, he was married, he had children, he did everything, and he was able to drop down into those deep levels of consciousness. Sri Yukteswar also was married, had child, was also learned how to do that. So the whole notion was that people who are active in the world could learn how to drop the RPMs down, get into that quiet state, even while they're surrounded by a life of activity. So there's hope. There's also no underestimating the challenge. The challenge is big. But even a little bit of this practice will make big changes for us. Even a little bit of this practice will give you a greater sense of peace, a greater sense of self, self-awareness. And so this is what we're looking for. So the master says, you know, if you're married, forget it. No, he doesn't really say that. But that he prefers a monk's life, and he himself was a lifelong monk. And so then he goes on to talk about Krishna, and that Krishna demonstrated that you're able to do it. And that Patanjali demonstrated that as somebody who had a family could also go into these places. Philosophically, I don't think that reincarnation is mandatory to accept. It's something when I first read a reasonable description of what reincarnation was, I thought, of course. It seems self-evident that that must be how things are. But whether you think you have one lifetime or 1,000 lifetimes doesn't really make any difference in terms of how do you make spiritual progress now, here, in the time that we have while we're here. So the heartening news with reincarnation is that whatever progress you make, whatever effort you make, you carry with you into the future. And if you've ever wondered, why do I have problems with fill in the blank, whatever this is, nothing in your life seems to kind of lead you to think why something is a particular problem. And a very reasonable explanation can be that's something you came into this life. You didn't come as a blank slate. And any of us who have had children, we know that children don't come in as a blank slate. They come in with very definite personality. Where did that personality come from? And so reincarnation explains that people come in with tendencies. And as you grow in your life, those tendencies can awaken. And others can be put to sleep. So reincarnation is ultimately hopeful that we can get it right. That we can get it right. So the first aphorism, reads, assuredly the exposition of yoga or concentration is now to be made. Now Yogananda points out, yoga and concentration are not synonymous. He says that's a misrepresentation of what Patanjali wrote. You learn to concentrate in order to meditate. And the way that I've broken it down is that meditation is both a verb and a noun. When you're trying to meditate as a verb, what you're doing is you're trying to concentrate. When meditation becomes a noun, you become that state of meditation. You become that inward calm, that inward silence. You become that. And at that point, it becomes a noun. And when people are talking about, I want to get into that silence, I want to get into that quiet, I want to get into that calm more often, they're wanting that RPM of the engine to drop down to where you're not in this active, active, active state where you're trying to meditate as a verb. You've actually dropped down into a noun. And as George pointed out, huge difference between the two. When you drop down, you know it. And suddenly, you know something different has just happened. Profoundly different. And what we'd like, of course, is to have that on demand. You know, just like the movie. I watch it when I want it, how I want it, you know. Same thing with meditation. Just click that. Where's that button at? Where's the remote control that says, okay, now I get to just drop down into that state. As Mother said, this is the pearl of great price. So it's not something that just comes naturally. It's something we have to practice. And as anything that's worth having, it's worth practicing. It's worth making the effort for. So concentration is a lead up or a part of yoga. Yoga means that this union with God. So concentration, you're not thinking about God. You become identified with that spiritual awareness that is God. So that's the difference. So first comes first comes the Sanskrit account of this aphorism is Atta Yoga Anishanam. Atta means so afterwards. Yoga means the union, and Anishanam means I am, describing the order of discipline. Why so afterwards? First comes Samkhya, then Yoga, then Vedanta. Now these are maybe unusual words for you. Samkhya means logic, means the reasoning. Why do we meditate? Why do we meditate? As I talked about in the talk earlier today, we meditate to achieve that union with God. Now, God is just a word in one sense. So it's a state of consciousness. It's a state of awareness that can be defined. And it's defined as Sat Chid Ananda in yoga. Sat is the pure awareness of self. The pure awareness of self. And it has always been and it will always be. When you have that awareness of yourself, see, most of us are identified with the body. So we think, well, I was born into this world, even though we don't generally remember being born. We don't even generally remember our first 7 years or so. Little snippets of time along in there. But that sense of, I have always been. I am not just this body. And then, consequently, if we identify with being the body, the fear of losing this body, either losing our health, getting old age, or dying, becomes at least a subconscious fear that we're constantly engaged with. What will happen? I'm on a time-limited basis here. And it all comes to an end. It's interesting that when somebody perhaps has been ill for a long time and finally the day comes and they leave the body, they're gone. It still comes as a shock to us, those of us who are still living. Because there's a part of us that resists the idea that this time that we have here is very limited. 70 years is like that. It goes by so fast. And so this notion of being attached to the body, identified with the body, we don't want to believe that this body has a limited time to it. And so we experience that shock when somebody dies, even though when we're very well prepared in a way that they're going to die. We're all going to die. You know, we could put up on the headlines of the newspaper, everybody in the world is going to be dead in the next 100 years who's living right now. Wouldn't that be shocking? Everybody living today is going to be dead next 100 years. Big headlines. And that's true. Very few exceptions. And yet, we act as if that's not true somehow. We act as if life is forever. The reason we do that is because in our spirits we know that we are forever. We know that there is no beginning and there is no end. But the problem is we identify it with being this body. In meditation, that awareness shifts from this body identification to spirit identification, and we realize that it's the spirit that lives on forever. This body is limited and will not last forever. So we take the logic of it, and that's Samkhya. And so if we're on basically the sinking Titanic, you know, if you get onto the Titanic and you know that it's going to sink and everybody else doesn't know that. So everybody else is eating and drinking and playing shuffleboard and having a great time. But you know, tomorrow we're going to sink. Everybody here is either going to be in very, very cold water or they're going to be dead. The ship's going to break in half and it's going to go down to the bottom. Terrible. And how would you feel during that? Your perspective is going to be very, very different than those people who don't know that it's going to sink. And they just think, this is a great time, fantastic liner, all the luxuries. So when you come to that awareness, that's what the Buddha did. Huh? That's what the Buddha did. He's walking through his garden, never knew really about death, and suddenly he comes up and he sees somebody who's dead. It shocks him. So we get those shocks every once in a while. But then, generally, we go back into amnesia. Somebody dies in our life, we're shocked. And then immediately we start putting that away as if that's not going to happen to everybody who's sitting in this room, everybody in this entire world. So we apply that logic, and so if I'm not going to be able to get it in the body, sat awareness in the spirit. Chit. Chit is conscious awareness. Wouldn't be any good to be eternally living if you were not consciously aware. So that's the consciously aware, and conscious awareness spreads out over all space. All space. And so there's no limits in spirit to how much consciousness can spread out. You can feel yourself to be a part of all nature, all creation, and beyond. And that's another quality of the sat chit. Ananda is blissful. Really wouldn't be satisfying to us if we existed forever and we were consciously aware, but we were just neutral somehow, or maybe we were in pain somehow. That'd be a sentence from hell, wouldn't it? What makes it is ever new joy. Ever new joy. Now we're used to in life, everything has a shelf life. Everything, every happiness only lasts for so long. And we may work and work and work, and finally we get some object we've been coveting and wanting so badly. And we have it for a little while, and it satisfies for a while, and we love it for a little while. And then the mind begins to wander. What else might there be? You know? Oh, there's a next generation of that television, or there's something else that's now available that wasn't available before. The mind just keeps going out and out and out. With ever new joy, that spiritual component inside of you is always satisfying, and it's ever new. Now that can confound the human mind because we're not used to it. We're used to everything. And I remember one time when I was walking along on a street and I was just feeling the bliss of God well up inside of me, and the thought came as a doubt. I wonder if this, I'll ever get tired of this. And so far, you know, 20 years later, not even close. Not even close. Somehow it's ever new. Somehow it renews itself. It feels new. It feels new. It feels ever new. And it's joyful. It's bliss. It's bliss. So that is Sat Chit Ananda. So Sankhya says, listen, everything in this material world is the sinking Titanic. Only in spiritual awareness and consciousness can you have that eternal nature and be conscious of it, and it is blissful and it is joyful. So we take the logic of that and we go, okay, if that's true, then I want to be more anchored and conscious of the spiritual and less attached to the things of the world, so that my happiness depends on whether good things happen or bad things happen. I'd like to have that bliss all the time, no matter what's going on in the outside. So that's the first part of it. And then comes yoga. Yoga is the method in this case. Yoga is how you get there. Yoga is the meditation technique that it takes you to get there. The third part then is Vedanta. And Vedanta is the I am state. The I am state of consciousness. And it is where you enter into that pure state of Sat. It is God the Father in Christian terms. And then the part who's conscious of creation but with spiritual awareness is the Son. That is the Christ consciousness. And the Holy Ghost is the Ananda. It's the blissful part of the nature. And so the same trinity of Sat Chit Ananda is reflected in God the Father, God the Son, the Holy Ghost. Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. A purely impersonal statement, I am. It's the great I am. And so this is the goal. This is the goal in life. Now, to have darshan, darshan means to see. And so to have real darshan means you see the infinite. You actually have a perception. You remember when it's reading from Ramakrishna, and Master Mahasaya said, "Can you see God?" And Ramakrishna said, "Definitely, you can." That's darshan. Darshan. Can you have the darshan of God? It's the actual God experience. It's not because of something you read. It's not because of something you were told. You have this experience, and the experience is universal. There are some things that are universal to human experience. If you saw a picture or a video of a child laughing, it wouldn't make any difference if that child was from Africa or South America or North America or from China or from Europe. You'd identify that child as happy. They're laughing. They're laughing. Uncontrollable stitches down on the ground, laughing. You don't need an interpreter. You don't need anybody to tell you what's going on for that child. If a mother has lost a child and is in grief, you see that mother in that grief. You don't need to be told what's going on for that mother. You know what's going on for that. That's universal. God experience is universal. There are different words. There are different stories that go around about what explains what that is. The essence of it is universal. And as you read the descriptions of different mystics all around the world, you'll find that there are identifiable features that don't change. And many of them trace back to that Sat Chit Ananda, the essence of pure existence, awareness, and bliss. And that comes back. Now, the Buddha said, "I'm not going to tell you what God is or what God is called because it's beyond words, and anything I say, you're going to misinterpret. So don't bother about the goal. Let's just start out with the means for getting there. First, you have to cut away everything that's not eternal and universal." So it's said to be nihilism. Nihilism is the negation, getting rid of. And it's the way of the yoni. The yoni says, not this, not that. When Michelangelo carved David out of the marble, and what he said is that the image of David was always in the marble. I just needed to chip away everything that was not David. And when I did that, the image revealed itself. It was always there in this hunk of marble. I just revealed it. So the Ani says, God exists, God is. But your mind gets saturated with everything else. So if you just chip away everything that's not eternal, not the pure essence of self, and not blissful, you'll end up with what is, which is God. It's a very tough way to go. Very tough way to go, because it's a constant negation. So the other side of that, and what Patanjali talks about, is focusing on the positive. That you have a positive view, and that is the Sat Chit Ananda. That's my goal. I've got the goal in mind, and it's not just around negation. It's about positively affirming. Positively affirming. So in the meditation practice that we practice, it's a constant affirmation tied to the breath that takes you toward the goal. Takes you toward the goal. So that God is necessary, and it's universal, and it's for everybody. And some people will say, well, you know, that's for religious people, or that's for churchy kind of people, and I'm not that. Doesn't make any difference. We're all subject to ignorance, which is not knowing God. And we all benefit and are really in need of the Sat Chit Ananda that's been described. So let me just stop there and see if there's any questions about anything that I've spoken about so far. Everybody got it? Great. Perfect. Now you can teach me. Good, you're all proficients. I love it. Ah.
Earlier you were saying that
Samkhya.
Samkhya is logic, and then here it says Vinyasa.
Yeah. Nya is a subcategory of Samkhya.
Okay.
So Samkhya is the system of thought, the big system. Nya is the actual word that means logic. But Samkhya is the logical, why do we seek something? We all have to know that. Huh? If we go to work someplace and somebody says, okay, do this and do that, we say, well, how come? We want to know kind of the big picture. Why would I even bother to do this? Because being in ignorance is painful. It creates suffering, is what the Buddha said. And the whole world is in suffering. Why? Because we identify with this body, and this body's going to get old, it's going to get diseased, and it's going to die. It can't help but produce suffering. Even if our life was perfectly arranged in every other way, those three truths will intrude upon our happiness. And it's what sent the Buddha off on his journey of realization. What's it all worth, then, if it all ends up in old age, sickness, and death? I got to know this. And he said, and not just for myself, but for everybody. Everybody else seemed to be rather unconcerned about it. But it concerned him. And so it doesn't concern most people. Most people just accept that that's how life is, even though they block that knowledge out. So those of us here are entertaining the idea, at least, there's got to be something more. There's got to be something more. So meditation stands to promise the realization of what that something else is. Okay? Any other thoughts, questions? And it's not necessary that you kind of learn a whole new another vocabulary. That's not what's important here. What's important, it can be interesting, but what's really important, see, the yogis have been like the Inuits and the Eskimos up north with their snow. They've got like 40 different categorizations of the snow. They depended on the snow for everything, for life. And so they developed a whole vocabulary. We've got one word, snow. Maybe it's wet snow or dry snow, but it's all snow. They had 40 different words. The yogis have lots of definitions around consciousness, because that's what they're interested in. And so they have a lot of different distinctions. They have a lot of different distinctions about levels of consciousness as you get into higher consciousness. We don't even, in modern day psychology and philosophy, there's hardly even a thought around higher consciousness. It just doesn't exist. And so they've got it graded out and said, if you're experiencing this, that's what that's called. If you're experiencing that, that's what that's called. They've got it all graded out. We've got a ways to catch up with them before we enter into that same realm that they're in. So yoga is the technique. Vedanta, then, is the ultimate goal. And that's what Patanjali gives to us, and that's where he starts things out. So if you would say, as a general course of how you think about your life, why are you here? What's your life all about? What would you say? Do you have an answer for that? Earn money?
Survive.
What's that?
Survive.
Survive, yeah.
Have kids.
Have kids, your replacements. Okay, and that's important, huh? Yeah. Any other? Why are you here?
Do my work.
Do your work, meaning?
To grow spiritually.
Grow spiritually, okay.
Burn off the karma.
Right. Okay, anybody else?
Well, I was just born one day.
Yeah, just kind of thrown into this world, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're
going to
live it out.
Yeah. Kind of like the father who throws the kid into the lake and says, okay, swim. How about some lessons? Nope, just swim. Supposed to figure it out as we go along. Yeah. Survive. Yeah, just live. Try to keep going. Any other thoughts? What are we here for? Be of service. Okay. So as Swami Ram Dass pointed out in The Divine Life this morning, this kind of notion of there's something about spiritual practice that's really self-oriented in the beginning. And so it's not necessarily about being of service, or although all of those things can be incorporated into it, or even about burning up karma, that kind of thing. It is about interiorizing the mind. And this is a huge kind of concept within meditation, is to interiorize the mind. When we wake up in the morning, generally the eyes open, maybe not wide, maybe... And then gradually we kind of get into the body, and then we're looking around, and we've got our things, we have our routines that we do generally, but it's all out there. It's what's coming into us from the senses and how we operate. If we are asked to interiorize our mind, generally if people aren't given music, television, a task, some physical activity, they do what? Go to sleep. Oh, nothing's going on? That's our unconsciously being a yogi. It's going to sleep. Because there's three stages. There's the waking state, according to the yogis. There's the waking state. There's the deep dream sleep. And then there is the dreaming sleep. So in the deep sleep, we don't dream. Not in a normal kind of way. There's no activity. We have become merged into the infinite at that time. By the time that we're dreaming and doing the rapid eye movements, deep dream or deep sleep usually lasts a couple hours. Then we're into a series of dreams. And we go from dream to dream to dream. And we're processing information. We're living a life, only we're doing it in the mind, not in the body. Then we wake up, and sometimes we feel like we've been hammered from dreaming all night long, and we've been very busy, and we go, oh my gosh. Sometimes we're very happy to be back in this world, because where we were dreaming wasn't so great. And so now I'm off into this world. If you can imagine interiorizing the mind and experiencing what you experience in deep sleep, if you could do that consciously, what would you imagine you would experience in the deep sleep state? What would that be like if you just let your imagination kind of go there?
Peace.
Peace.
You definitely wouldn't be in your body.
Body awareness wouldn't be there. What would you be aware of? So that's the not. That's the negation, the ani. What would you be aware of?
Well, the word that comes to me is space.
Space. And not a tiny little space.
Big space.
Okay? Peace. Space. Yeah. Okay? Say nothing, and yet there's something in the sense that you're aware, aren't you?
Aware of the space.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is sat chid. Sat is the self, you're self-aware, and the space, you're aware of endless space or a huge space. That's sadhya. Peace is ananda. That's the feeling of God. Any other thoughts or associations as you think about that deep sleep? If you were consciously aware during deep sleep?
I think it's
the freedom. All the pressures, all the anxieties, all the expectations, it's all off the table. Freedom. Okay? Great. Okay. Exactly right. Anybody else? would it be profound to have that awareness? I think so. That's beginning to speak to the deep states of consciousness that we can go to. And I love the analogy of the body of water, that when the wind is blowing and it creates the waves, it obscures anything getting reflected in the water. The breath is the wind. Quiet the wind, what happens? The body of water becomes mirror-like. When it becomes mirror-like, you're able to see what's reflected from above. There's a mountain, there are stars, there's the sun, there's the moon, all reflected in the water. Consciousness is like that. Normally, we have lots of waves, all these thoughts, all these impulses, desires, fears, everything keeps the water agitated all the time. Calm all of that, suddenly everything above begins to get reflected in that water. The mountain of spiritual consciousness, the light, sunlight, spiritual consciousness, the stars, the moon, it all gets reflected. And it happens automatically. Not something you have to strive out or go out for. It happens as a matter of course because you've stilled all those wavelets. So deep meditation begins to do all of those things that you describe: wide open space, freedom, peace. And in addition to that comes these revelations about what is reality. What is reality? Now, Sigmund Freud was a major thinker in psychology. And what he discovered was the notion of repression. And so we go about in our life and as little children, and we know as parents and as little children, there are certain things that you repress. You don't just get to haul off and sock somebody because you're upset with them. You learn not to do that. What do with it? You stuff it down. When you stuff it down, according to Sigmund, if you stuff down enough, it begins to creep out around the edges. You become neurotic in different kinds of ways. And so this is as far as Sigmund went, is that this is the sum total. And what he thought was the best you could do is kind of get good at managing your neurosis and create a healthier, happier life. But nothing more than that. He himself was Jewish, but he rejected all of that. He saw that God the Father, as talked about in the Old Testament, was a projection of the Father image, the Father complex. And that's it. Nothing more than that. It's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Because as the yogis did, they went further. And they found out we're not made up of yucky id stuff. We're made up of divinity. But to get there, you're like going down through the different layers. You have to get through the yucky id stuff. The id is all those objectionable things that you had to stow away because it's not okay. Poop is yucky. Why is poop yucky? It's just poop. Well, because we were taught it was yucky. And so we have this kind of disgust around it. Little tiny children, they don't have any disgust. Oh, that's interesting. Draw my face in there. And, you know, no problem. So we go, ooh, you know, because we've been taught that. That's the id. That's the yuck factor. So it's also the forbidden fruit. So we chase after certain things, too, that have been repressed. We have to get through all of those layers. But if we do, and we're tenacious about it, what happens then is we get to the gold that's underneath all of that, the spiritual gold, the really good stuff. Where most people, many people, get stalled is getting through all of that. Yeah, they get a little taste of the gold here and there, but that id is not easy because it's whatever it is for me. What bothers me may not bother you and vice versa. And so we all have our stuff. We all have our desire nature. We all have our repulsions. And life is made up. This is what the yogis identified in the heart center as the chitwa. Chitwa is like a fussy old lady. Ooh, I don't like that. Ooh, I don't like that. Oh, isn't that nice over there? I want some of that. Nice little cookie over there. It's either the repulsion or the attraction. And most of us live out our lives either feeling repulsed or attracted by various things, and it consumes us. It consumes us. So to get through this id, to get through this muck and mire, we have to be tolerant of stuff coming up. Now, some people described encountering fear. Absolutely. And the way that I experienced it was, I think I must have been reading about submarine warfare at the time, because they were talking about submarines and how they go down through different thermal layers in the ocean. And for the ocean, different thermal layers is like the difference between ground and air. It's that different if you're attuned to the ocean. It's just a very definite ecology that goes with different thermal layers. Different fish live there. If you're doing sonar and radar, there's things that are almost impenetrable and passive kind of sonar. And so it's these very definite layers. And you go down and down and down in meditation, and you get to a certain layer, and you pop right back up to the surface again. Whoa! That was scary. Or that was an objectionable. I didn't like that. Now, we all encounter that to some degree in life. But as meditators, we're going directly for that. You're trying to calm the mind. All of this stuff will naturally come up to your conscious mind that's in the unconscious mind. So if you think of having a basement where you've been throwing the refuse and the junk for eons of time, and pretty soon it's kind of coming up through the heat vents and it smells and it's yucky, and you go, oh my God, I got to get down there and clean that out. That's what meditation is. It's opening the door, letting it all come out. Go into the burning barrel, going into the burning barrel, but it has to come out through the main floor, through the conscious mind. And so in our meditation, we go, well, that's not fun. You know? Isn't that my old junk? And what do I want that for? And that's not what I want. I want new stuff. But to get to the new stuff, you got to go through the junk. So that's what happens. We sit down to meditate. Well, that's nice at first. And then we start daydreaming about our day. That's everyday unconscious. And then sometimes some of the nightmarish stuff starts coming up. Now, in my book, that's good. It's up and out. Up and out. But when you're experiencing it, it doesn't feel good. That's not what you want. And things can be, it can get rough. It can get rough. And if you, when you get tolerance to that and ability to let it go up and out, it relieves it then. You let it go and it's gone. This is absolutely necessary, and its mother called it the pearl of great price. There's no getting around it. We created it. We have to let it go. We have to let it go. So, anybody ready to get up and run out now? Not what I wanted. Thank you very much. I wanted a quick, easy way to enlightenment. Any thoughts about that?
If I work really hard to the job, to get away from that feeling yucky, or you have to feel yucky,
there's kind of two basic approaches, and they're reflected in Jesus' teachings, and it's resist ye not evil. Resist ye not evil. And that is being the observer. You don't get into it. You don't resist it. You watch it. You watch it go through. And you watch it going into the burning barrel, into the light. You let it go. You let it go. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But You're actively letting it go. Now, let's say you're going about your life and suddenly you get this impulse to do something you know is wrong. You know, you're in a store and it's like, oh, you know, I could just slip that in my pocket and, you know, nobody would notice. And okay, out the door you go. You know it's wrong. And then at that point, you know, Jesus said, resist the devil and he will flee. So we get both instructions, resist ye not evil, and resist the devil and he will flee. So if there's something that's pushing you to action, then you can resist it. So there may be times when thoughts come up in meditation and you very definitely, devil, get thee behind me, you know, just, you know, get it, push it away, get rid of it. Other times when the more we fight it, the stronger it seems to get. And we let it go. We let it go. And at that point, it gets rid of the fight. And the fight was the thing then. And how do we get out of the fight? How do we get out of the idea that life is a battleground? We become an observer. We watch it. Oh yeah, there's that thought. There's that impulse. There's that feeling. Okay. I'm breathing. I'm observing. I'm watching. I don't have to fight it. I also don't get into it. I don't get into it. And that can be easier said than done at times. But I don't allow myself to identify with it. I am always me. That's just a thought. So I can say I have thoughts, but I am not those thoughts. I have feelings, but I am not those feelings. I have a body, but I am not that body. I am the eternal self. And we keep affirming that again and again and again and separating ourselves from whatever that is and being the observer and breathing with it. Okay. So that's a way that we can stay out of the battlefield is don't resist it, don't identify with it. That's not a call to just go with it. If it feels good, go with it. It's observe it. Watch it pass right on through. Okay. So does that make sense, kind of like what the structure of this looks like in terms of the id and yucky stuff and that's kind of what's going to happen? It's part of meditation. I'd like to say there's some get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, but it's work. However, it's worth it. It's worth it. Yeah. Okay, so let's take a break. 10 minutes or so. You know, recycle the tea and coffee that you had earlier. And refuel up and we'll come back together. Okay. Right. There are times when we have to fight it, and we have to, but that's probably a minority of time. Majority of the time, we can just simply watch it. And, oh, that's interesting. There's that thought. Mm-hmm. There's that feeling. There's that impulse. And how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like I'm having to do that a lot, though. Like, everyone's still keeps coming back. But
if you think about drilling deeper, and when you drill deeper, you're going to get more into the unconscious. Then it's actually a positive sign. Because it's all stuff that wants to get released.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was like this battle, and then finally I surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, that was huge. But it's like there's still more.
Right.
So now it's like, okay, so I went from fighting, and then now I'm at surrender, and now I'm like, okay, now I'm going to observe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, but you mean, so it's a good sign because it means that I'm getting deeper?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's all queuing up, wanting to get released. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So.
I just have a question. Mm-hmm. Kind of confused that when you've told us in the past that when we have thoughts, we should, some of them we should just say stop.
Yes.
No more. Put the big X over it.
Right. Okay, what's the confusion?
Well, which one?
Which tool do you choose?
Yeah.
It depends. So if we're trying to control our thoughts, or we're trying to observe our thoughts, what's the right tool? I would say, as a general principle, to be the observer is better. But there are thoughts that become intrusive, and at times we can just say, enough, stop at this. I remember when I was about 19 years old and I had periods of depression. And it was a spiritual crisis. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what it turned out to be. And I felt myself one time slipping into that depression like a comfortable pair of old slippers. I was surprised at how seductive it was to move into that. And just mentally, I just screamed, no, I'm not going to do that. And I successfully pulled myself out of that and switched routes. There are times we can do that. There are other times when we command something to go away and we get into a struggle. And it seems like the more we battle it, the bigger the struggle becomes. And suddenly you can just shift to that observer mode or surrender, and it dissipates. It was in the interaction of the fight that it was drawing energy. We find people that way too. Huh? You know, some people thrive on conflict. And the more you fight with them, the more they fight. They're better at it, so it's hard. You know, you go, gosh, why do we keep doing this? Because they get energy out of it. There's psychic parts of us that are like that too. Others that we can starve to death with lack of energy. We don't give them any energy, they dissipate. They go away. But some things can be pushing you to an action or pressing in so hard on you and you feel it and you command them to leave. And they will. So there's no kind of real rule around which do you use. It's what's effective, what works. And particularly, if you're fighting with something and it just seems to be getting stronger rather than getting better, try observing it. If you're observing something and you're feeling drawn into it, command it. And see which of those two is more effective. Okay. And one of the things we talked about in the break, too, is that this notion that I've been meditating and something comes up and I dealt with that and I kind of feel like, okay, I've dealt with that. That's good. It's gone. And then at some other time, it starts coming back again. And we can feel defeated. And we can, oh, really? You know? And I think a nice description around it is from Johnson's book, Spirals of Growth. And it's in a spiral. If you can imagine like a spring, something that starts out smaller and gets higher and wider with each time it comes around. Now, every time you come around to a particular point, that's going to be that issue. And you spiral around and you come up higher and you're wider. Your consciousness has grown up and more, but it's the same point again. And you come around and you match it again. And you keep doing that. Because there's only so much that a part of you has judged you can take on that moment. And you do that, and you do it successfully. But it's not completely routed out. So each time you come around, you're able to take it in a deeper, more profound way. And therefore, sometimes it can seem like the struggle is harder. It seems like what you're encountering is even more than what you had before. Because you're taking off a bigger piece of it, a deeper piece of it. Your consciousness has grown up, and you're stronger, actually. But if you don't know that, you think that you're getting worse, because it can seem like it's a bigger struggle than it was before. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So the other kind of analogy that came to me through all of this is, I haven't played them too much, but kids' games, where they get proficient at the beginner level. And they have, you know, things coming at them, people shooting, whatever it is. And they get good at that, and then suddenly you earn the privilege of going to the next level of the game. Now, these things are coming faster, they're a little more sophisticated. And if you didn't know that you dropped into a new level of the game, you'd think, I'm getting worse, not better at this game. I was really good up there, now I'm worse at it. So once you understand, oh, this is a brand new level of the game, okay, I got to pay attention. Because before I was kind of coasting a little bit, it seemed kind of easy. Now this seems hard. I have to really pay attention. So if you know in your consciousness, as you drop down, you can take things deeper and deeper and deeper, you have to keep on your toes. You can't just coast. Coasting doesn't work. Okay. So we'll shift from kind of the macrocosm down to the microcosm of your experience and how to meditate, the method. What I'm going to talk about here is a combination of things, but it's... So we'll be talking about the Hong Sa method, and we'll be talking about the flame method. So I'd like to start out with the flame method, because that's primarily with the observer. And what I'd like you to do is just as we're sitting here, I want you to think of whatever it is that you're feeling, whatever it is that you're thinking, and to imagine that it's a movement of thought, it's a movement of feeling, and that there is a flame, a column of light in front of you, and that everything that you're thinking and feeling, both emotions as well as physical sensations, is moving into that column of light. So if you just like to partially close your eyes or close your eyes all the way, and first of all, just be aware of the thoughts that are in your mind, of the feelings that's down heart center area, of the physical feelings. It can be aches, pains, enjoyment, whatever it is that you have there, positive or negative. And open up an avenue in front of you and see and feel those thoughts, those emotions, those feelings flowing into that column of light that's in front of you, 12 to 14 inches or so in front of you. Whatever it is, positive or negative, knowing that whatever is good, whatever is right, you cannot destroy. Whatever, you might say it this way, whatever is of God will always remain. Whatever is of Sat Chit Ananda will always be with you. You can't give it away. So you don't have to worry about giving away anything that is absolute truth. But everything else goes into the flame and is impurified in that flame. Some people are stronger at seeing. Some people are stronger at feeling. A few people are stronger at hearing. So you can feel it going into that flame and see and hear through feeling. You can see it going into the flame. You can hear it moving into that flame. Or all three. And so you're opening up the avenue. Your thoughts are flowing in from your head, forehead area, into that flame. Your emotions from the center of your chest area are flowing into the flame. Physical sensations, physical drives, physical whatever, likes and dislikes, all go flowing into that flame. And that you breathe. And I'm going to have you breathe in a particular way. You're going to breathe to your stomach. And by that I mean, when you breathe in, and if it helps, you can put your hand on your stomach. When you breathe in, your stomach slightly rises. Now, it doesn't need to be exaggerated. It doesn't need to be a huge deep breath. When you breathe out, your stomach slightly contracts. What this does is it gets you breathing down to your diaphragm. Many people do not breathe to their diaphragm. They use the top 10% of their lungs. And many of us are oxygen starved. When people are yawning, that kind of thing, you're oxygen starved. So I want you to breathe to your stomach. And then open up those avenues so that your feelings, your emotions, your heart center area, the center of your chest, see, feel, hear, those emotions flowing into that column of light, taking them up and away, neutralizing them. From the center of your forehead, your thoughts, daydreams, images, whatever's there, flows through that avenue into the column of light, takes it up and away and neutralizes it. This promotes the observer mode within you. You're observing. You're also giving an avenue for those thoughts and those feelings to go, or physical sensations. The contrast to that is the merry-go-round. And when your thoughts are on the merry-go-round, they just go around and around and around. And I know nobody in this room has ever had that problem, but you probably know somebody else who has. And those thoughts just don't go anywhere. And oftentimes they're distressful, uncomfortable thoughts. So instead of putting them on the merry-go-round, which does nothing for you, you give them an avenue to go. You put them into the flame. And you release them, you let them go. And as I say, you don't need to distinguish between positive and negative. If something is good, if something is true, the light will refine it and leave it with you. If it is not good, if it is not true, you will take it, burn it, and neutralize it. So breathing to your stomach, opening up the avenues, and like a river, it flows out from you into the flame, into the column of light. And as you work with this, as you do this, I just want you to observe what the result is of doing this. What do you feel? What do you notice? Other than the flow of these thoughts going out and these feelings and emotions. If you have any physical pains, knee hurts, if you're a little cold, a little too warm, whatever it is, open up an avenue and let that pain center flow out into the column of light. If you have a headache, anything at all. Is a powerful way to help cleanse the mind. If some thought, memory, something from the past comes up and is very disturbing to you, just breathe. First breathe down to your stomach. Then open up that avenue and let it flow into that flame. For goodness sakes, why would you ever want to hang on to it? And observe what you experience as a result of the flame exercise. If you find your mind wanders into a daydream, then just let the daydream, whatever it is that you are daydreaming about, let it flow into that flame of light. In that sense, there are no wrong thoughts or wrong feelings. If there are no thoughts and no feelings, just stillness, you don't have to do anything with that other than remain in it. That will become that calm body of water that will begin to mirror what is above, the peace, joy, light, expansiveness. And sometimes, because it's such a natural process, you can be much more expanded, much more peaceful, a profound state, but you don't actually know it in the moment until you come down from that experience, and then you think, oh my gosh, that was wonderful. Because it is such a familiar kind of feeling, even though you may not have ever experienced it in this lifetime. But some part of you instantly recognizes it and says, yes, of course. And that this sense of peace and light and joy is more valuable than gold or fame or anything else that you can name. Maybe some sensations that continue to stream out to you. Some of it goes, but some of it remains. It's all right. You'll sense it, you'll feel it when it resolves itself, when it's complete. Some things disappear very quickly, other things take longer. Nothing wrong with that. Just keep the avenue open. You may suddenly become aware that you've closed off the avenue. And consciously or unconsciously, some fear has entered in. And you've cut it off. Be aware of the resistance of the fear and open an avenue for that fear to leave you. Will help to interiorize your mind. Brings the mind in. A step toward the true self. You to take a little deeper breath. If you like, you can just wiggle your fingers and your toes, remind you that you have a body, but you're not your body. And observations about what you experienced as you utilized this flame exercise. Uh-huh. And in what sense? What's flowing in versus what's going out?
Life force.
Uh-huh.
And that's the expansion. And the medulla gets really, really big.
Uh-huh.
My medulla. And the more that this is going out, the more I'm aware it's being replaced with something very nice.
Very nice. Good. Positive. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Great. It goes a little bit beyond our exercise today, but exactly right. Yeah. And as you do that, you may hear the Om sound, the high-pitched sound at the back of the head. Feel that life force flowing in from behind you, as well as what's flowing out in front. Anybody else? Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Great. That's what I would predict. Mm-hmm. And no resistance. You know, you don't have to resist a thought or a feeling, or it's just taking exactly what's coming to your mind, what you're aware of. Yep.
Everything.
Yeah. That whatever's true, whatever is real with a capital R, won't go anywhere. The flame will just, if you imagine the flame as a purifying force, and that it just takes away whatever's negative, whatever's bad, and leaves the rest. And you have the rest. So you don't have to distinguish between what's good or giving away something that you think is essential to you. You can't. You couldn't do that even if you tried.
It's funny, you always think that the flame is for the bad.
In this, in going into the deeper aspects of meditation, everything goes in, because everything, every thought is a limitation, even a good thought. So, oh, there's a loved one. Or there's something I really, it goes into. It goes into. Because ultimately, any thought, any emotion, any feeling will become a limitation. And as I say, whatever's true and whatever's real out of that will remain with us. The rest is purified. The way it works for you. Everybody will have a little different experience of it. Yeah. So that's your strong visual person. So it comes out that way. Other people may not see anything. It may completely be on feeling. They feel it leaving and going. But they can actually see through the feeling. If I ask them what color was that feeling, they'd be able to tell me. But they won't see it in the same way you will. Great. Any other observations? Anybody have difficulty with it, didn't have those experiences?
I think because I took a cold medicine and battling with the fog.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just...
Yeah.
And then it's like, and then I'm trying to focus, and then the flame.
Right.
And then when I finally put my, you know, sort of looking up,
mm-hmm.
like, oh. Okay.
That helped, looking at the ajna, at the third eye point. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, yeah.
And it was just more, I could just feel the flow, and not so much with this, and then there's this, and there's this, it was just more steady.
Right.
And
even when a tiredness or something can be from a medicine that we've taken or something, but if you imagine seeing that tiredness, that exhaustion, flowing into the flame. What would you imagine once you give that movement, given an avenue, and you give up movement of going into that flame, what would you notice about that? So I would say that with tiredness, with depression, with other kinds of things that either feel like they're weighing on us or we're sinking into it, that this gives another route for it. It gives it some place to go. And once we get that sense of movement, of letting it go, seeing it going, it changes it. It makes it dynamic rather than feeling we're victimized to it, whatever that is. Yeah. Good observations. Anybody else?
I noticed that I felt alone, not in the sense of loneliness, but I kind of forgot that it's here in this room.
Yeah. That's taking a step into the pure sense of self. And there's an interesting aspect to that, that as we move into the pure self, it somehow makes us feel not necessarily separated, we're just not aware of the other. We're just totally into that experience. As that develops and grows, we realize that through that true sense of self, we're connected to everything. But initially, that's not generally how we feel it. We feel it as a drawing in. That's the indrawnness of the mind. And then the paradox is that the more we draw into the mind, then the more we feel our connection with everything that is. Yeah, good observation. Everybody get a general sense of quietness inside? Yeah. Good. So that's the first step, and that's being the observer. And I think you mentioned being the observer and watching and just this opening and allowing things to move through when you sit to meditate. It's a great way to prepare yourself for meditation. And it's a cleansing. It's not a true meditation in the sense that it can be. I'll take that back. It can be a true sense of meditation, but it's more of a technique for cleansing and letting go and really prepares you for meditation at that point. And you can use it at any point in meditation. If in your meditation you find something coming up strongly and powerfully, open up the avenue, let it go right into the light. You can use this anytime, any place. You feel some emotion growing and you start getting frustrated or angry. The cats are bothering you while you're trying to meditate. Into the flame. Into the flame they go. Whatever the thoughts are, it shouldn't be this way. It should be easier. All into the flame. All in the flame. Something's wrong with my life. I got given the wrong life. I know what life I'm supposed to have, and this is not it. All into the flame. All into the flame. And you just give it some place to go. Instead of that merry-go-round, where it just goes around and around and around, drives you crazy and does nothing. has nothing. Okay? So, the next step then is the Hong Sa method. And this is also connected with the breath. And so we'll also be breathing down to the stomach. And breath, mind, and spirit are all connected. When you focus on the breathing itself, that's a powerful technique, just right there. So this is combining a breath with an affirmation. A breath with an affirmation. And this is going to be a Sanskrit affirmation, but I will also give you an English one if that's easier for you. In Sanskrit, there are 51 different letters. They each correspond with a particular sound or a particular vibration. And if you count up in the number of in your chakras, these wheels that are along your spine, if you count up the number of petals there are on all these chakras, it's 51. So each one corresponds with a different state of consciousness. We concentrate here at the ajna. And this is called the doorway to God. And it's the way that you'll see in Egyptian thought, you'll see a serpent that comes out from the ajna. This is symbolic of the arisen energy that has come up to this spot. You'll see representations of the third eye there at this spot. And Jesus said, "Let thine eye be single, and if thine eye is single, thy whole body shall be filled with light." This is it exactly. And so this is the point of focus that we come to, is right here. So as you breathe, I just want you, either with partially closed eyes or closed eyes, just be aware of the breath as it enters in through the nose, comes up through the passages and down to the lungs. And then as you breathe out, how the air passes up through the passages and back out through the nose. And again, I'd like you to breathe in a way that the stomach rises and falls, rises and falls. When you breathe in, I want you to think the word Hong, H-O-N-G, Hong. This is a Sanskrit word. And when you breathe out, I want you to mentally think the word Sa, S-A-U. As you breathe in, you mentally think the word Hong. As you breathe out, you mentally think the word Sa. When you're really quiet and you listen to the sound of the incoming breath, it'll closely correspond to that word Hong. And when you do the outgoing breath, it'll closely correspond to the word Sa. Now, these two Sanskrit words mean the I am, the great I am, the pure Sat nature of the Sat Chidananda. And if you prefer, or if it's easier for you, you can mentally think the word I on the way in and am on the way back out. If you're more traditional Christian, you can think of the word Jesus coming in, Jesus coming out. can also think the word Krishna or Buddha. But in most cases, keep it with the Hong Sa, if that's agreeable to you. So you are focusing your attention at the origin of your nose, the point between the eyebrows. As you breathe in, you correspond the word Hong with the breath coming in. As you breathe out, you correspond the word Sa as you breathe out. This is the positive affirmation, the looking at the ajna and the affirmation of the great I Am, the Hong Sa. If other thoughts, feelings, sensations come to you, you can just let them pass right on through, right into the flame. And keep your attention on the Hong Sa. You don't have to think the words I am. The vibration of the Hong Sa automatically corresponds to that consciousness, the Christ consciousness that exists there, the Chaitanya. Kutascha Chaitanya is talked about in Sanskrit. And it's very simple. It's very direct. So let's practice this for the next few minutes. I'd just like you to observe as you do that, just what, if any, effects you notice, your thought, feeling, your awareness. If some daydream comes or your mind wanders a bit, just send it into the flame. Draw your attention back to the ajna, point between the eyebrows, the hong sa. Start to feel sleepy, open up an avenue, send that into the flame. Or anxiousness, or anything at all. And now take a slightly deeper breath. You can take a couple of those, wiggle your fingers and your toes. It can be deceptive how much consciousness shifts, expands, and is lifted up. So just want to be a little careful when you get up, operate a car, machinery, or pour a cup of tea. Just be a little extra mindful and careful, because it can be quite not all in your body. Okay, let me check in here and see if there's any observations, thoughts, comments. All the things that were disturbing or would normally crowd in. Yeah. And that's the, it's the positive, giving something for the mind to focus on, rather than just trying to clear things out. That's the yani. This gives you something, and it's a positive affirmation and focus for the mind. Yeah, exactly right. So good. Good. That's what it's supposed to do.
Or driving.
Yep. Hopefully not the two at the same time, sleeping and driving.
Starts to bring that center back. Center back of this just starts to fall.
And you can literally use it anytime, any place. And if it's if it's mid-afternoon and you're having one of those kind of drops of energy, and just if you have an opportunity, partially close your eyes or close your eyes and just 5 minutes. You can come out wonderfully refreshed. You're tapping into that same consciousness as deep sleep, but you're doing it consciously. So the same kind of rest that you can get from deep sleep, you can get from this meditation. If you're driving, of course, keep your eyes open, but you can do and pay enough attention to the road, but if not too much is going on, you can do your Hong Sa, and just a way to really take a dip into that nice, peaceful, expansive consciousness. Did anybody notice how useful it is to have the flame exercise along with the Hong Sa to give something's disturbing, interfering, give it some place to go? It's nice, particularly if you're shifting from kind of a busy day, or it's nice just to clear. And then if you feel, oh, you know, there's just not that much content going into the flame, I can shift to the Hong Sa now. There's tons of content. You may be just competing with that while you're trying to do the Hong Sa, and you just may get frustrated that it's kind of tough going. It feels like a battlefield then. And instead, just go ahead and do some clearing out. Let it move out. And then it starts to calm down. Okay, now I'm ready for doing the Hong Sa. Yeah, so I think that's a good strategy. If you wake up in the morning, you're getting up early, and I want to meditate in the morning. It's nice to meditate twice a day. It's nice to pick out a routine. Okay, this is my time for doing this. And, that tiredness is, I just haven't kind of woken up. It's nice to get up, wash your face, comb your hair. Brushing your hair, actually, it stimulates the nerves in the top of the head. It's a nice thing to do if you have hair to comb. And kind of go through a little routine, a little bit of stretching, and then sit down. And you can let that tiredness, that exhaustion, so much of that is an energy as much as anything. It's not just pure physical exhaustion. It's something that's clinging on to us. And by opening up the flame and letting it go, we can actually clear a lot of that kind of feeling out. Now we're ready. Now we're ready to be alert and to meditate. Some people have a terrible time with going to sleep. They go to meditate and immediately... You know, that's resistance. That's the mind saying, I'd rather be doing anything else than this. And so I'll put myself to sleep if you're not going to let me do anything else. So just as soon as that kind of overwhelming exhaustion or tiredness comes up, send it into the flame. Send it into the flame. And then whatever may trail in after it, it may be some fear, maybe something that you're battling with, let it all go into the flame. Any other observations, thoughts, questions? Kind of numb. Yep. The body can, go through a lot of different kinds of. You can send that into the flame too. Just that tingling, numbing kind of, just send it on in, because it's a distraction. Ideally, in Sat Chit Ananda, you've never been more awake. Your body's not necessarily active, but you feel a kind of tingling, vital energy all through your body and all around you. And so just clear out that kind of chloroforming or going to sleep kind of feeling. That's just part of the resistance.
You were saying earlier that why we feel everlasting is because of our spirit.
Yeah.
And I felt as if I was, I felt my spirit. I felt like I was becoming spirit. I was almost previewing my eternal life. I was previewing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that Jesus said that where is the kingdom of heaven? It's right within you. Some will say, lo, it's over there. Some will say, it's over there. It's right within you. And it's not some distant time. He says, there's many standing here that shall not taste of death till they see the coming of the kingdom. So it all exists right within you. It's here and now. And we imagine that always that it's, oh, when I die, then I'll get the answers if there are any, and then I'll go. It's here. And that was the good news. We don't have to wait. So not just previewing, but knowing in the moment. And it's part of our nature. It's part of our true nature. This is exciting stuff. And the potential is limitless. It's just what our brains put. That's the limitations that we face. It's what our brains say, oh, that's enough. That's enough joy. That's enough freedom. Don't want to go further than that. Why not? Yes, that's right. And that kind of bouncing back up to the surface, when that happens, oh my gosh, I'm going to get up and I'm just going to get going. That's resistance. We've met some fear there, and it happens so fast. The mind is really, really fast. It happens so fast, and suddenly we've been down in that deep state, and suddenly, oh, I got to get busy here. This is enough sitting around time. And we know that we've hit some place. And to some extent, the price is just coming up against it again and again and again, passing it into the flame, letting it go. We can use our techniques. To some extent, we breathe, we let it go, we let it go in the flame. We just have to dig through it. Just have to let it come. Let it come. We don't really have to dig. It comes, whether we want it to or not. Sometimes we prefer it not to. And I remember times when I felt so much fear, and I thought, this is craziness. There's nothing for me to be afraid of, but it just engulfed me. I just had to sit with it. I just had to be with it, with the technique, with the Hong Sa. And if you think of Hong Sa like sawing through wood, and you just, okay, let the saw do its work. Let the saw do its work, and it'll cut through that delusion. But there's a certain amount of time that we just have to be with it. That's challenging. But you know what? We wouldn't think that we'd accomplished anything if we hadn't faced the challenge. Okay. Well, thank you for coming today. I've extended us a little bit past our time, but I appreciate your patience. And pronouns, I bow to the light within you. You're more than welcome to keep in touch with me, email, telephone call, if there's things that come up. I always warn, there's times when I'm not able to get back to you, but when I can, I will. Okay.